Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I have as my guest Richard Ford. His new novel is called Canada. It's published by Echo Press, a new publisher for him. Well, he's, you know, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer of many books, and he's been a guest on Bookworm many times. And I feel like this new book, Canada, really has brought to the surface many of the mysteries in Richard Ford's writing, which is to say, I want to say this straight out, that what he does is to present oppositions, disguise them underneath beautiful writing, so that basically everything is turning into opposites. Twins are distinctly fraternal twins. The border between America and Canada, presumably nothing happens to us when we cross that border. We're in two different states of mind, which suddenly, with a flick of a wrist, of a writing wrist, become the same place and a different place and the same place again, and we're constantly faced with the switching of identical allegiance. Is that something like what's going on for you, Richard?
Yes, it is. It is something like. I got very interested in how things that look alike are very dissimilar, and how things that are very dissimilar, if this just doesn't seem redundant, begin to look alike to us, and that what we have to do is somehow within ourselves reconcile those things, live those things through.
Live them through, but what is reconciliation? What does it involve? Can it be done?
Well, it involves behavior, I think is what it involves. It isn't necessarily an act of intellection. It's an act of whatever is going on inside of you causing you to behave one way or another so that you can, for instance, outlive the fact that your parents became bank robbers, outlive the fact that two men are murdered in your presence, so that you just have to, by your actions, do that reconciling.
Yes, this is a novel, Canada, narrated by a man in his 60s who was thinking back to when he was 15. He was 15 in, I believe, 1960.
Right.
And, you know, it was a different culture. Let's yes. face it, but it was the same culture. It was American culture.
Exactly.
And his parents, who weren't even hippies or rebels, rob a bank. They literally, well, they've thought about such things, you know, and certainly this is the country of Bonnie and Clyde, and a culture that will have a movie that makes Bonnie and Clyde into heroes. But they are not Bonnie and Clyde. They're, you know, a strangely matched couple who haven't done anything out of the way beyond marrying each other.
Exactly. They are the most loving two parents that two twin kids could possibly have. Their life is, if in every way, the American life. Father in the Air Force, mother's a teacher. They live in small-town America. Everybody's happy, slightly insulated, but they're insulated in the family. And then suddenly this terrible rupture occurs in which the parents get out of money and owe money to some bad guys and they rob a bank. Yeah.
Not just suddenly, but there's the mother. Her parents are Jewish. She is well on the road to assimilation. Her name is Neva. The father's name is Bev. Immediately this man who has a girl's name, which he insists is a man's name always, the opposition, they meet one night, go home from a party together. Neva gets pregnant and having twins, and they get married.
Exactly.
With no one's approval. And their marriage is the predecessor of their decision, suddenly, to become bank robbers.
Exactly, exactly. They made, the book says that they made a tiny miscalculation, which was for either for her to get pregnant or for them to get married after she got pregnant. And ever after that miscalculation, like a miscalculation in an arithmetic proof, things get further and further away from when things made sense.
Now, you said about this book that you had the idea for it years ago, but at the time you didn't have the chops for it.
That's right.
What are the chops?
Well, the chops for me were simply to organize enough material to make what prompted this book to have a life be plausible. I had the notion of a kid being dragged against his will across the border from America to Canada to Saskatchewan from Montana, and I had to figure out, for instance, why such a thing could ever happen and make that plausible and also make it interesting. And then I had to figure out, on the other hand, which I did not have the capacity to do in 1989, what happens to him when he gets there? Indeed, what is his fate? And then I had to figure out also down the line in part three of this book, what sort of life he ultimately accedes to.
I thought, actually, that the task was not just making it plausible, but making it implausible enough and then saying, but life is like that.
Well,
this
not,
is what we do.
You're not wrong about that. I mean, there is a belief that I have that, I mean, there's a line of Randall Jarrell's who said that a novel is a long prose narrative that has something wrong with it. And by that, I don't necessarily mean that it is flawed, but that it has something at the heart of it that is improbable. It is quite improbable that these two people would rob a bank, and yet that's what I had to have them do. So once I commit myself to having them rob a bank, then I have to make it seem to make sense. I have to make their lives seem malleable in such a way that they would do that. And likewise, when he goes to Canada and he meets this terrible man, I have to make those improbabilities, which is to say a double murder, also seem plausible.
Well, I would say that one of the scariest people in this book, and I felt so happy because one of the great accomplishments of your early fiction, say in Rock Springs, was to make bad guys more frightening than even they were in Flannery O'Connor's world. And here we get some of those scary people again.
Yes.
In particular, one named Charlie Quarters.
Yes.
And
a Métis, which
yes.
is just a half French, half Indian.
Again, the immediate opposition, the joining of opposites,
yep.
Indigenous and Canadian, and man-woman.
Right.
He's a scary guy who wears eyeshadow and rouge.
Yes.
And what he's going to be known is tougher at his most feminine than he is when he hasn't made himself up. So that's what I think we're dealing with. Every time we turn around, we're facing the Canadian-American border. We're facing twins who are fraternal twins and don't look anything alike. We're facing a bond that is, in fact, an opposition.
Right. You know, I think that this is something I read someplace, that drama is good when the villain says something that makes sense. And for me, his villainy is all the more palpable and all the more trenchant when he begins, these people begin to act like real people. I mean, if the devil went around dressed in a red outfit and horns and a tail, we would know to stay away from him. But people are much more virulently evil when, in fact, they seduce us, and they seduce us in this book with good sense.
Sometimes, yes, but I think further, the most seductive behavior is silence.
Oh.
Because it can be projected into. And your real bad guy in the book, Arthur
Remlinger,
begins talkative, but then he turns it off. Yes. And our hero, whose name is Dell, has to, you know, this is going to be something like his foster father or mentor. And
correct.
He's waiting to hear something. And, well, Arthur isn't saying anything. Am I liked? Am I loved? Am I wanted? Am I tolerated?
Right.
Who am I?
What he's done is he's had to confront at 15 years old, he's had to confront the facts of adult life, which is to say, here is a man who's ostensibly taking care of him, who's become his guardian, who in fact has virtually no interest in him whatsoever because he himself is sort of preoccupied with his own doings and his own fears.
I'm talking to Richard Ford about his new novel, Canada, and what we're establishing is that a child is going over the border into Canada, into a new life that reflects the old life, except when it doesn't, when it gets stranger still. And that in this book, we're being taken again and again over a border by the novelist into a still more difficult set of behaviors that we have to learn to accept. In other words, we're being taken from the 60s to the 2000s, where once there was black and white, and now there are all kinds of shades, nuances, different tints of gray.
It was always my wish to make the book sort of transit from the 50s to the 60s, which is why the book takes place on that pivotal year of 1960, and then to have 19 or 2000 and whatever the book ends at, 2008 or 9, be where the book resides finally, to sort of see that arc of consequence.
And to see, to some extent, culture breaking apart. I mean, the great predecessor of this book in your own work is that story Communist,
yes,
where the boy, again, I think he's 16, he thinks he's going to go to college, but this is the beginning of the world that breaks apart, where not any longer will a person of sensibility have a college education. We're going to see acts of love turn into acts of violence. We're going to see love and violence being concealed by an enormous act of beauty, which in that story is the beauty of the prose for the reader and the beauty of a flock of 5,000 geese,
right,
rising over everything and thereby concealing distinctions in a great cloud of white.
There's another moment of beauty in that story when the mother says to the little boy, "Do you think I'm still feminine?" And the little boy at age 16 has to step up and say to his mother, "Yes, yes, I do think you are," which, ooh, is for me an act of such devotion and affection. And in that instance, he grows up by having to tell his mother at a moment of great weakness and when she's been abandoned that she is, in fact, feminine in his eyes. I mean, he has to become what he's not anymore. He has to become something other than her son.
He has to be her man, but do we, right, do we really like that moment? This is a novel, Canada, by the way, in which an act of incest is buried inside a paragraph, so that one of the known taboos, and even fiction writers avoided it for years and years, has become in this novel, in a certain way, something that is accomplished and makes him so nervous that he says it in the shortest space possible. Because again and again, people are taken out of their orbits of comfort in this,
right,
book.
See, I think in this book, this act of incest between brother and sister when their parents have abandoned them and been thrown in jail is an act of consolation.
Yes, desperate consolation.
Right, but an act of love and an act of understanding and an act of empathy. You know, someone asked me the other day, they said, "Gee, did you mean that to be an act of incest?" I said, "Yes, darling, I did, because I thought that they were all each other had."
The narrator of Canada, all these years later, who is a teacher, he seems, we expect him to be deranged, but he seems the stablest character now in the book. He seems to be able to teach others. He recommends to his students the identifiably great novels of resolved conflict. How do you have a character whose parents have turned bank robbers, who's witnessed a double murder, who's, you know, really, you know, the he's had an incestuous relationship with his twin sister.
He had an incestuous moment.
Moment. Yes, you're right. You're right. But he does not become what we think he'll become. He becomes in some way an infinitely paternal presence in the story of this novel, which is about himself, as if he's saying, you see, you still can go through what people would define as the worst and come out the other end.
Right. This is what life asks of us. This is what life asks us to do, because we have, particularly as children, but all through our lives, we really have no control over the stuff that's got to happen to us. We walk out a door, we think that everything's going to be rosy and the sun's going to be shining, and we walk into a situation we could never have imagined, and yet we are asked to make sense of it, to intercalate those things, make them be part of our lives, and go on. There's that line of Ruskin's that the book quotes, which is, the composition is the arrangement of unequal things. That's what composition is. That's how you compose your life. You reconcile unequal things.
And it's implied that that's how you compose a novel as well.
It is implied. That's exactly right.
And what are the unequal things that this novel composes or balances?
Well, it and here we're back to your opposites again. It balances great familial love with the parents basically abandoning the children to go rob a bank. It balances a projectable life in which you go to college with the fact that suddenly that's all basically erased in front of you. It balances living a life in the hinterlands of America and being suddenly thrust across the border to someplace you could never have imagined being in your life, which is to say the prairies of Saskatchewan. It balances murders, as you said, with the necessity to go on beyond it.
I love this because I think one of the things that got subsumed, you see, this is just me being Michael the bookworm.
We like this, though.
Yes. See, I think that The Lay of the Land, which was your previous novel, had been written in a language so Emersonian that you could hardly see through it to its events. This is a novel now that's alternating between that beautiful language, the language that's, you know, beyond visualization, to acts that are so stark and amazing that they seem on the verge of comedy, and that to my mind the great achievement of this novel is to balance this extraordinarily beautiful writing with this imbalanced set of events and forms and plots.
That's what I'm always trying to do in this book, which is to say, find a way to tell something which is so outsized, which is so outrageous, and as you say, in some instances ridiculous, to utter that in a way that lets the reader know this kind of thing, as ridiculous as it might be, actually is the kind of thing that makes up our lives.
I'm talking to Richard Ford. This is Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. I'm talking with Richard Ford about Canada, a novel so exciting that even my producer, Alan Howard, sat down to read it and couldn't stop. It's 1960. A Montana teenager's parents are arrested for bank robbery. His family is destroyed. The boy seeks refuge in Canada. There, he tries to reconcile his feelings and thoughts with events that overwhelm him, including murder. Now, around 10 pages before the end of the novel, there's what seems, well, it's a long time to go before a topic sentence, but the sentence talks about the inevitable drift northward of everything.
Yes.
Right. What is that?
Well, that's just that's the author's view of the way in which the sort of horrors that sometimes inhabit American life begin to sort of seep upward into the north, into Canada. I mean, and if you talk to Canadians now, they will tell you the very same thing, that the predations of the right are actually coming to Canada now in their own government. So that's, in the most explicit way, that's what that means.
Because, you see, in an interesting way, this book is all narrated by a man named Dal Parsons. Having lived through these depredations, he's now a school teacher, and it's almost as if he needs, in writing this book, to be able to come to conclusions at last after a good deal of living. And so he'll talk about the inevitable drifting of everything northwards.
Right.
But I think he's pulling at straws. I think he's trying to make sense of his life, that his life doesn't make sense, and what the reader is being asked to do is to understand that life doesn't make sense in the old ways, that you can't pull it all together, however much this hero may want to.
There is some reconciliatory impulse in him at the end of this book to generate some of his own consoling conventional wisdoms about life, which is to that extent why he's a teacher, but because his conviction is that finally you simply must take a position, that you can't just be a waif on seas that throw you one way and throw you another, that you finally have to right yourself. And he tries in intellectually and emotionally and you know, maritally, to write himself, even though it's as anyone's writing of himself is somewhat artificial.
Well, he has a desire, he tells us. He tells us that unless he tells us about the bank robbery, nothing will make sense, and certainly not the murders.
Right.
And you think, bank robbery, murders, okay, gotcha, but makes sense.
Right. You know? Well, making sense is not a thing you inherit, or maybe you used to could inherit it. Making sense is a thing you overtly do. You imagine how things in this Ruskin way fit together, how the unequal things compose a life. You don't take it on faith from other people, because if you look around, other people are not giving you anything that you can take on faith.
Well, yeah, but I would say, you see, it used to be, you know, again, of the novels, this novel bears the most relation to wildlife,
right,
a novel
does.
I'm crazy about, and which had, to my mind, a harrowing dance sequence with the mother snapping, and what was it, mambo or cha-cha?
It's cha-cha.
Yeah, and the boy dancing with his mother. You know, to my mind, parents in your work are always asking children to do the job of spouses.
They are. That's exactly right. I don't know why that is something, but I guess I should say I don't know why. I know why, because it happens all the time. That's why. That's what children are asked to do, because parents are just human beings. They aren't institutions. They aren't monoliths. They're constantly asking their children to shepherd them, to take care of them. There's nothing unusual about that, nor is there anything wrong about it. It's just tough.
Richard, would it be fair to say that in the New World Order, if in the past a novelist was finding meaning, that presently a novelist is suspending the need for meaning, and that a novelist might spend a career getting to the point where that suspension can sustain a whole novel?
Well, it is true. What you're talking about is something that actually lives in Walter Benjamin's wonderful essay, The Storyteller. And yes, I mean, the novel creates a shape, an artificial shape, in which its logic predominates, and it lives outside of the logic that is in the world. And so yes, that I think that's absolutely true. But I mean, we can't finally live our lives in novels. You do, I do, to a certain extent. We have to take this intellection, we have to take these lessons and go back out into the world with them and not be terrified.
By the end of the novel, I would say that the lesson is the tone of the end of the novel, which is a tone of terrible sadness.
I would have. That's interesting. I've never thought the novel ended on a sad note. The last words were, "All right, we try. We always try." I would have said that the novel ends on a note of what Seamus Heaney calls ascent, A-S-S-E-N-T, that Del basically ascends to the world, ascends to his place in it. Now, that may be, for some people, saddening. For me, I guarantee you, it is not saddening.
It's interesting to me because he sees finally his sister again after 50 years.
Yes.
And again, we expect that the novel is going to come to some statement of resolution. Instead, she's dying. There's nothing really that they share together except this moment.
That's right.
That's what I'm talking about when I talk about the sadness at the end of the novel, that there isn't, you know, well, we've gone through it and look what the years have done and we have each other.
There's not that. But he does hear her out. He travels to see her. He does all of these small and significant things to credit her existence. And it may just be that in my sensibility, I take the Sartrean view that to write about the darkest possible things is an act of optimism because it proves that those things can be thought about. I do think that. I'm looking for moments of elevation, looking for moments of reconciliation, of affection being expressed. And when I can find a way to write those, well, I'm glorying in the opportunity to write them, particularly in this book, given what's gone before.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I've been talking with Richard Ford, author, most recently, of Canada, published by Echo. Thank you, Richard, for joining me.
You're entirely welcome.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Canada at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Join me for part two of my conversation with Richard Ford about his novel Canada, next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.